I appreciate you allowing me to suggest that we divide the room tonight. It's not something we do traditionally in the insight meditation culture in America. The only place that it's done is at IMS on the 3-month course. It's not done at Spirit Rock except for a talk like this. Sometimes I'll do it, and I don't know of any other time. But it's very traditional in the Theravadan world, in the world that insight meditation comes from. If you go to a monastery, it's very common for men and women to be divided in this way. And at least in San Francisco, when I've done it, people have a big reaction often. I mean, I've had people tell me they were offended the week before when I just told them that we were going to do this. And I don't actually mean to offend anybody, but I do hope that you just get a little taste of what it's like, since we don't do that much. And for some people, they really like it. Some people, it feels really safe or relaxed or easy. And for some people, it has the opposite effect. It feels very uncomfortable and artificial. And of course, traditionally, one of the reasons to do this was around sexuality and sexual energy. The belief that kind of dividing male and female would divide the energy or make it calmer for people. Which, of course, didn't take into account the people who might be more excited sitting with people of the same sex. But we'll talk about that as we go on tonight. This is going to be a 2-part talk. I'll do a part one this week and part two next week. And neither part is comprehensive. Tonight what I'd like to do is just give you some basic overview of sexuality from the Buddhist tradition. Some different snippets or stories and perspectives that I found when I looked in the tradition to see, well, what was there about sexuality beside the precept? Because I'd heard about the precepts on every retreat I've ever gone to, that the precept on around sexuality, about not misusing or not acting on one's sexuality during the course of a retreat, and then as one goes home, there's some talk about the precepts and non-harming. That's the main teaching around the precepts, not creating harm through our sexuality. But I didn't know much about anything else about Buddhism and sexuality, except some vague idea that you're not supposed to do anything, kind of. And it's been very interesting for me to study a little bit, research a little bit, learn a little bit about the sex life of the Buddha and the sex life of other people in Buddhism and how sexuality has been held by different people at different times in different Buddhist traditions. And I don't come as a sexpert at all, or an expert in terms of sexuality. I've done a little bit of my own investigation in general over a lifetime, with all its pluses and minuses, sometimes really interesting, sometimes good, sometimes bad. I'm not going to talk much, if at all, tonight about the difficulties around sexuality, which are myriad, both for human beings in general and also in the Buddhist tradition. I'm not going to talk much about that. I will just give you a little bit of a glimpse, as I said, of things that kind of interested me or caught my attention as I went through the tradition. And my hope is that it stimulates your own interest in researching or looking or seeing what's come before. And then next week I'll talk much more about the place of sexuality within mindfulness practice. The other way we could say it is the place of mindfulness within sexuality practice. the place of concentration within sexuality practice. So I'll talk more specifically to sex, sexuality, our sexual expression in whatever form as a part of practice next week. One of the first things that struck me when I started talking about sexuality, asking about sexuality, learning about it a bit, was that in the Pali Canon, in the traditional texts, when they were first translated by a woman named I.B. Horner, that she actually wouldn't translate certain parts of the traditional teachings because they were too sexual and too explicit sexually, and she was offended by this. And so what she did was she translated most of the Pali Canon into English, but the parts around sexuality that she was offended by, she translated into Latin. So you could only read the good parts if you knew how to read Latin. But I think it speaks a little bit to the feeling in a lot of religious traditions about sexuality is either dangerous or it's bad or it's to be suppressed or repressed at times, or somehow it's not to be included fully. And I guess I think it might be helpful for me to say my own agenda here, which is about hoping that these talks help you include your sexuality as part of your Dharma practice and not something separate or different or weird or wrong, especially as householders. I think that's very important, and I hope to make a little bit clear the distinction between the teachings for monastics, which are very clear about sexuality, which is don't do it, and the teachings for lay people, which is the same as doing commerce or handling money, which also the monks traditionally don't do. They don't handle, or the nuns, they don't do. They don't handle money. But as lay people, it's fine for us to do that. It's fine for us to be sexual. It's how we relate to our sexuality is when it becomes Dharma. So when I looked in the Buddhist tradition, I looked at the traditional texts, the suttas, the Vinaya, the teachings for the monastics. I also looked in Buddhist myth and legend, story, teachings, practices, all around sexuality. And it's definitely mostly male-oriented, that most of what I found had to do with men or oriented towards men. And I tried to include what I could from the feminine more, but it's definitely a smaller portion of what's available to us. The Buddhist tradition is a patriarchal tradition, is historically. And in fact, which is, one of the major changes that's happening in our time in the West, which is it's not hierarchical in the same way, the way the teachings are presented, and it's not patriarchal in the same way that traditionally they've been. So, again, I like to apologize beforehand so that it's not that I don't take this into account when I talk about these things. I realize this, but there's also certain limitations given the tradition. So the first piece, let me just ask, how many people read the article in the Inquiring Mind about sex? I'm just curious. Okay, a couple. Good. Because it was taken from this first talk, so I hope not to bore you too much with the same thing. But how many people know about the Buddha's sex life? Besides the people who read the article. The Buddha had a very active sex life. It's not talked about very much. You don't hear about it usually in the Dharma talks. It's not the first thing they tell you. More they talk about enlightenment, or the struggle towards enlightenment, or the teachings that he gave after enlightenment. But the Buddha was very helpful to consider him in his time and place and culture. He's a prince. He's in what is now northern India. He's upper class. He's high caste. For a prince at that time, it was very common to have a pretty active sexual life. And they talk about especially that his father, you may have heard stories about his father wanted to keep him on the farm, so to speak, or keep him in his where he lived to become the king, because his father was the king, wanted him to follow in his footsteps. And even to the point that in the traditional teachings I often heard about how the king would have the dead flowers picked at night so that the Buddha would never see anything like that. He would never see anything that would make him unhappy, so that he wouldn't leave the kingdom and go follow, pursue his spiritual interests. But what I didn't know was that also the king arranged for him to have like the best sexual life so that he would also stay at home. It said the king had a special chamber of love constructed for Gautama. Before he's the Buddha, Gautama Siddhartha. Decorated with erotic art and illuminated with subdued light like that of a hazy autumn sun. Captivated by sexual extravagance, the prince spent his days and nights in continual dalliance, experiencing every imaginable sensual delight of heterosexual intercourse with the beauties of his vast harem, and when he tired of them, with the professional goddesses of love in neighboring pleasure groves. So you don't hear about that so much, right? I mean, that's, you know. You hear much more about his ascetic practices before he's the Buddha. And that's interesting. You'll hear why in another moment. Just remember, he practiced every sensual pleasure. Okay. Another story that I found important, or at least very interesting, was the traditional story of how the Buddha become, or how he turns from the his royalty to go seek awakening, is that he comes in contact with the four heavenly messengers. And you've probably heard this before, but if not, I'll just repeat it simply. He's never seen anybody who's ill, and he sees somebody who's ill. He's never seen anybody who's aged, and all of a sudden he sees somebody who's aged, comes into contact with somebody who's aged. He's never seen anybody dead, and he comes in contact with a dead body. And then he also comes in contact with a wandering mendicant, a practitioner. And it's these four events that have a very powerful impact on him. Remember, he's been protected by his father, because his father doesn't want him to be unhappy. And now he breaks the bind of his father, and he sees the world, and he goes into a kind of existential dilemma about, well, what do I really want to do with my life given sickness, old age, and death? And he's inspired by the wandering practitioner, mendicant, and so he leaves the castle, the palace, and he goes to seek enlightenment. That's the traditional story that I've heard since I was quite a young man growing up in the Dharma. But there's an alternative story that doesn't have to do with the four heavenly messengers, but goes something like this. One night, following what was evidently a frenzied orgy, Gautama awoke from a troubled sleep and took a hard look at the people surrounding him in the love chamber. Lying about in torn clothing and disheveled hairs, with the ornaments, tiaras, musical instruments strewn about, the people were far from a pretty sight. Some were naked, contorted into unseemly position, legs and arms askew. Others were snoring loudly with their mouths agape, mumbling to themselves in their sleep or drooling in a drunken stupor. In the hard light of the oil lamps, the people had lost all their allure. For the first time, Gautama noticed the blemishes and flaws of people. In reaction to this and the meaning, and revolted by the such meaningless excess, he felt as if he had come to in a cemetery full of the living dead. And it's from this moment that he goes to seek enlightenment. And it's an interesting story, it's an interesting myth, because many people I know have had this experience, not quite this dramatically, but the experience of excess, whether it be with drugs or alcohol or sexually, a certain kind of indulgence, and when we might have believed that that's what would make us happy. And that at some point we really see, oh, this is really not so good. And there's a kind of turning that happens where people look for something that's more satisfying, that's more meaningful, and that can often lead to their spiritual practice. Now again, the Buddha said, there's not a single sensual joy which I have not enjoyed. And there's a Buddhist text, the Buddha Charita, which says that each potential Buddha, and let me say it this way, you've often heard how we should emulate the Buddha, or the Buddha's life is set up for emulation, right? That we see that, you know, when he turns away from worldly life and he seeks awakening. And in some sense, it's an archetypal story. And it's an archetype that's presented over and over again and inspired people over and over again for thousands of years to seek awakening and to consider our own life and our own turning towards awakening. But in the Buddha Charita, it states that each potential Buddha must taste all sensual pleasures prior to illumination. Everybody hear that? So that each potential Buddha, like if we follow the path of the Buddha, must taste all sensual pleasures prior to illumination. It's not a teaching we give so often. And I'm not actually saying it's the true teaching. I'm just saying it's something that I came across in the course of investigating sexuality. So the Buddha leaves home after tasting all sensual pleasures. And what does he do? He does a big pendulum swing, which again, maybe you've done this. Maybe it's been around food or alcohol or drugs or sexuality. Did we blow the whole system? No, we're okay. Can you hear me? Not so well. Testing, testing, testing. There we go, about there. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So he does this big swing. So he's this totally hedonistic prince. He leaves, cuts his hair, gets rid of all his jewels, all his possessions, comes down to one robe, shaves his head, and now he does all the most severe ascetic practices known in his time. And so it's said that even at some point he's living on one grain of rice a day. And he often is proud of the fact that nobody can say he hasn't done the severest ascetic practices. So he goes from very hedonistic to very ascetic. And this is important in the understanding of how he comes to the middle way. Because one way the middle way is defined is the way that transcends both hedonism and asceticism. And it's actually a beautiful story in the text when he's almost dying, and it's a young milkmaid who feeds him, who offers him some food so that he lives. And he realizes he needs to care for the body in a way. And so there's this shift to this much more compassionate view of the body. First he's a total hedonist with the body, then he's totally hard on the body, and then he finds, oh, there's a way to care for the body. There's a more compassionate way to act that really includes the life of the body, that's to understand that the body itself is the vehicle for awakening. That's, it's in this human realm that is considered, in Buddhist cosmology, is the optimal realm for awakening, in the human realm. It's considered a better realm than the heavenly realm or the deva realms. Much better, because they're sporting all the time. They're having such a good time, they don't even think about awakening. There's no way. And it's considered much better than the lower realms, the animal realms or the hell realms, because those realms are, the suffering is so great that there's not really the luxury of awakening. But the human realm is considered optimal because there's enough pleasure and enough pain, and it's balanced enough, and there's enough years generally that it's considered optimal for awakening. What time did we start? Stop? 9 o'clock. Wow. Oh, we're going to edit here on the run. So let me say a few things about the tradition. For the monastic tradition, it's very interesting that they're not allowed to have sex. And especially given the teachings of the middle way, one person said it's like trying to fence in the ocean to not have sex. And there are different understandings about why the Buddha suggested that the monastic tradition be celibate. Two main things stood out for me. One is to create a kind of cohesive community, a very cohesive community that was different than normal community. And so if people were being in a monastic community and having sex, they would then have all the normal responsibilities that come with sexual activity, i.e. children, and then all the responsibilities of caring for children. And they couldn't have the kind of cohesive community, unique community, and also the freedom that comes with not having children. The freedom to move and go and wander, which they did all over the Indian subcontinent. Pretty much in the same vein, the orientation was to have as much time and energy for practice as possible. And especially seeing practice in terms of intensive meditation practice. Now, one of the parts I found very interesting is if you read the rules around the rules for monastics, it's very helpful to understand that the Buddha didn't set out a bunch of rules and then people came and joined. What happened was people came to the Buddha. They said, "Who are you?" or "What do you teach?" And he taught. And they said, "Oh, I want to come study with you. I want to be with you. I want to learn from you." And he said, "Great, come on." And then people started doing things, and the things weren't helpful for the way he was teaching and the community he was building. So he started creating rules. So all the rules came in response to things that happened. And if you read the rules, all the first rules are about sexuality. All the first rules. So he didn't start out abstinent, but people were having sex. And he said, "Well, this is not so helpful. So if you want to study with me, don't act on your sexuality, celibacy." And so first there was the rule was no sex with women. Then the rule, people were getting around that rule, so he had made another rule, no sex with men. Well, people were getting around that rule, so then he had to make a rule saying no sex with animals. Okay, and people were getting around that rule, so then he would have things like, well, no sex with pieces of fruit. People were getting around that rule, so no sex with the mud is one rule. I mean, and, you know, you could just consider that the Buddha was this, you know, relatively young man who was attracting, at the beginning, before the order of nuns, he was attracting young men who were, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, in their early 20s, many of whom had been of his class and caste, and who were used to a certain kind of lifestyle. And it wasn't so easy to just be celibate. It's not so easy generally for young people. The friends of mine who I know who went off and became monastics at in their 20s, I only know one woman who's 17. Christina Feldman was 17 when she went off and practiced. It was hard. It was difficult for them. And that was a difficult piece. It's actually a little easier as we get older and we're not driven biologically in the same way as we are as young people. Now, the Buddha could be a very strict teacher. This was also something, I read this when I was first in teacher training with Jack Kornfield, and I was absolutely shocked when I read this. And some people think, oh, I shouldn't read this to students because it's shocking. But I think it's actually helpful to hear the things that aren't so good in the Buddhist canon, so that we learn very much how to discriminate for ourselves what's useful and what's not useful, because not all of it's useful. So the Buddha said, as part of his admonition to the young men who were acting out sexually, he said, it is better that your penis enter the mouth of a hideous cobra or a pit of blazing coals than enter a woman's vagina. That's pretty strong teaching, huh? Very, a little strange, kind of. I don't think that's exactly true, personally. But I know where I fall on this question. I'm definitely not into snakes. So, I think it's important to hear it because there are there's actually a number of what I would call misogynist statements in the Pali Canon that are very harsh in terms of towards women. Or the idea of women or sexuality. The Buddha also gave some very traditional teachings about how to help one, if you're practicing celibacy, how to help practice in that way. One way, and you can do this whether you're a man or a woman, is to see whoever you're seeing, depending on their age, either as your daughter or son, as your sister or brother, as your parent, mother or father, or grandmother or grandfather. And to begin to actually look in that way and to see people in that way. And so that the familial helps break the thrall of the sensual, of the image of people. He also taught a very traditional meditation on what's called the loathsomeness of the body or the unbeautifulness of the body, where you start to examine the body not just on the surface, but underneath and see what's here. Especially if you're interested in breaking the or lessening the thrall of sensual desire. So to really reflect on what's inside, and you know there's an interesting art exhibit in LA that I'm hoping to go to. It's a little strange, I'll admit, but it's somebody in Europe has figured out a way where he's taken human corpses and plasticized them in some way. And so they're from autopsies, and they're real bodies, but they don't decompose. And it's an exhibit that's in LA, and I know a few people who've seen it in Europe who said it was a religious experience, that it was quite amazing to see, because you see inside the body and you see what's actually here. And the other teaching that the Buddha gave was to be mindful. So when Ananda said, how should we behave? How should we behave towards women? And the Buddha said, don't look at them. And Ananda said, but what if we must look at them, you know, if they come into our vision? And the Buddha said, don't speak to them. And then Ananda said, but what if we must speak to them? And the Buddha said, keep wide awake, be mindful. And we could extrapolate these the other way. You know, we could say, well, what if we have to see men? Oh, you know, don't talk to them. You know, what if we have to talk to men? Be mindful. And again, these are teachings from monastics. Oh, I have so much here. I can't believe 45 minutes is so short. Really. So I'll tell you one other piece from the monastic tradition, and then I'll jump. And it really has to do with the warrior attitude, which the Buddha has in his teaching quite strongly and comes down through the tradition often. And this is Ajahn Chah, this is Jack Kornfield's teacher, talking about conquering lust. And he's talking about a time when sexual desire rose in him so intensely that he could not concentrate. And especially in the walking meditation, he says, regardless of the position, walking or sitting, that I took in meditation, an image of the female genitals kept appearing. Lust was so strong that it almost overwhelmed me. Had to struggle hard to fight off the intense feelings. Struggling over lustful feelings was as difficult as battling the fear of ghosts in the forest cemetery, which is a very powerful practice for Ajahn Chah and for a Thai native where there was a lot of belief in ghosts and still is. He says, the lust was so intense it was impossible to do the walking meditation as the penis became sensitive when it came in contact with the robe. I requested a walking meditation track be made deep in the forest where I could not be seen. In the dark forest, I rolled up my lower robe all the way to the waist, tied it, and kept it up with my walking meditation. I battled the defilement for 10 days before the lust died down and disappeared. A little from the Theravadan tradition, from the kind of practice of conquering lust, in order to let the mind concentrate very fully, very completely, to focus, to do the kind of intensive meditation practice that brings awakening in the Theravada. In the Mahayana tradition, there's a more of what I would call a sex-positive attitude, or at least positive towards the possibility of acting, of including our sexuality in a way where we act, not just including it in a celibate way, but including it in a way where we get to act with our sexuality and include it as part of awakening. And it's this question is summed up in the koan, the red thread. The Zen master addressing the assembly said, in order to know the way in perfect clarity, there is one essential point you must penetrate and not avoid. The red thread of passion cannot be severed. Few face the problem, and it is not at all easy to settle. Address it directly, without hesitation, for how else can liberation come? And in the Mahayana, what I found is actually a lot of sexuality, a lot of monks and nuns, let me put it this way, there's more monks and women, not so much nuns, who are active sexually and included as part of their spiritual life. They don't see it as it's not to be gotten rid of, but it's to be included. And so you have someone like EQ, who's was considered both a rogue Zen master. Like when he was enlightened, when he had his enlightenment experience, he was giving an Inka, which was a certificate of enlightenment. And EQ was such a rogue, he just ripped it up. He like wouldn't have anything of that, because he knew enlightenment was not about some paper. And he was quite a little bit of a bad boy of Zen for quite a while, but by the end of his life was so revered for his kind of ruthless honesty and directness and integrity that he was made the abbot of the biggest monastery in Japan, even though he'd totally been a rebellious to the institutionalized Zen of his time. And he wrote a lot of poetry about sexuality. And here's two poems about genitalia. He says, a woman's sex. Now let me start with the other one. A man's root. 8 inches strong, it is my favorite thing. If I'm alone at night, I embrace it fully. A beautiful woman hasn't touched it for ages. Within my underwear, there is an entire universe. Okay, it's a little different than what we've heard so far. A woman's sex. It has the original mouth but remains wordless. It is surrounded by a magnificent mound of hair. Sentient beings can get completely lost in it, but it is also the birthplace of all the Buddhas of the 10,000 worlds. And so you start to get a different relationship now with sexuality, that it's not just to be conquered or even just to be celibate, but more relational. There's some women poets, and what I found was a whole stream of poetry and women who combined sensuality and spirituality through their poetry and their writing, and who aren't also afraid to challenge the monastic community around this. This is from Yosano Akiko, who writes, you've never explored this tender flesh or known such stormy blood. Do you not grow lonely, friend, forever preaching the way? Or from, I'm forgetting her name. Ikibu, I can't remember it offhand. Anyhow, I'm going to read her poem anyways. She said, concentrated so completely on each other, I can't tell us apart. You, the white bush clover, from me, the soft white lily. And a whole different understanding of interconnectedness. Or there's poems also about being so close but knowing that our bodies will drift apart. And the understanding of impermanence being talked about in terms of sensuality. And there's also a strong sense of compassion around sexuality and sensuality, that it's not just to be conquered in the same way. And so there's a story of an old woman in China who supports a monk for 20 years, and she built a hut for him and fed him while he meditated. And then she wanted to test him at some point, and so she had a young woman, a girl that it's put rich in desire, probably a courtesan or something of that order. And she said, go and embrace him, and then ask him suddenly, what now? She wanted to test the monk, see what would he do. And the girl called upon the monk and without much ado caressed him, asked him what he was going to do about it. And the monk said, an old tree grows on a cold rock in winter. He said somewhat poetically, nowhere is there any warmth. And the girl returned and related what he had done, what he had said. To think, I fed that fellow for 20 years, exclaimed the old woman in anger. He showed no consideration for your need. no disposition to explain your condition. He need not have responded to your passion, but at least he could have evidenced some compassion. She at once went to the hut of the monk and burned it down. So it's a different flavor now around sexuality, sensuality. We have 3 minutes. Huh? I don't think we'll get to everything. But I'll say just one more piece. If you move to the Vajrayana tradition, you have a whole other emphasis on sensuality and sexuality in the tantric teachings. And you have actually what are called tantras, just like there are sutras. There are tantras that begin with this line. If you read the suttas, they all begin with, "Thus I have heard." And then the Blessed One said this and this and this. But then some of the tantras begin, and they begin, as the Buddha was resting in the vagina of his consort, he gave these teachings. So this is very far away from the sense of, you know, it's better to put your penis in the mouth of a poisonous snake than to touch a woman. You have a whole different flavor. And you have teachings that are symbolized by what's called the yab-yum. Yab-yum, I'm sure you've seen this in the Tibetan paintings, where you'll see a Buddha or awakened being of some sort in sexual embrace with his consort. And they also have some where it's a woman, a dakini, embraced with her consort. And it symbolizes, the symbolization is the unity of wisdom and compassion. And it's symbolized through this embrace, through the sexual embrace. Interestingly, I go to Amsterdam and teach a few times a year these days, and the biggest brothel in Amsterdam now is called the Yab Yum. The other thing too that I think is important to know that I'll just say in this briefly is that the tantric teachings, which are about including very fully one's sexuality, are mostly done symbolically. That they're rarely acted out in terms of men and women. They're done as visualizations for most people, for most practitioners. That there's a visualization of this kind of unity, of this kind of sexual embrace as part of practice. And then there are some practitioners who act it out with partners. And this is a little different than the Nouveau Tantra that is very much in Marin County. There's a very big, what's called Tantra movement. It's actually very big in Holland also. A lot of people involved with spirituality who are involved with Tantra. But this is not the Tantra of Tibetan Buddhism. It's a little bit its own thing, although it may draw some from Tibetan Buddhism. And then, can we go over 5 minutes? Can we do that? If somebody has to leave or you're bored, I'm not offended at all, but I just have to say a little bit about our time. In the last really 40 years, as the insight meditation community has planted and grown in the West, in Europe, and in America, there's been a lot happening around sexuality. Actually, let me say it this way. As Buddhism kind of planted in the West in the last 50 years, in terms of Westerners studying Buddhism, there's been a lot happening around sexuality and Buddhism. When people first came to Suzuki Roshi Zen Center in San Francisco, it was the 60s. People were being very, very sexual and asked a lot of questions of Suzuki Roshi about how to practice. And I'll read you a couple. So one person asked, is it necessary to have sex in order to have complete understanding? He asked Suzuki, and Suzuki Roshi answered, he said, maybe you shouldn't have too much sex, but maybe you shouldn't have too little either. So he's much more the middle way. Or one student said, I have a lot of sexual desire. When I sit, I just get more. I'm trying to concentrate on my practice, so I'm thinking of becoming celibate. Should I try to limit myself in this way? Suzuki Roshi said, sex is like brushing your teeth. It's a good thing to do, but it's not so good to do it all day long. And Suzuki Roshi also had this beautiful capacity to know when to turn away from things. And so the story, and it's really from the author of Crooked Cucumber, who was going to be a monk. And in order to take monk's vows, you're supposed to agree not to get involved in a relationship for 5 years. And Suzuki said to him, since you're going to be ordained, it would be better if you didn't have a girlfriend for 5 years. And he, what's his name? Who wrote Crooked Cucumber? Anybody? David Chadwick. Yeah, so David Chadwick said, he said, oh gosh, Roshi, I don't think I can do that. I have a girlfriend here now. Don't you know that? And Suzuki said, don't tell me. And so you hear a kind of practicality relaxed inclusion of sexuality, that it's part of our life, and we can practice with it in a variety of ways, whether it be celibate or whether enacting our sexuality. One of my teachers once said that it's really easy to get awakened here and here, and it's really hard to get awakened down here. And I always thought that was really interesting to hear. One other piece I'd like to say is about homosexuality. And this is just Eugene's personal opinion, the confusion in Buddhism around it. And I believe the limited understanding in Buddhism traditionally, which is that it's wrong. And the word sin is not used, but traditionally the teachings say that sex involving hands, the anus, or the mouth is sexual misconduct. And that's usually applied. That's how homosexuality is talked about. Now, I don't know what traditionally people think that heterosexuals are doing, but, it's interesting that even the Dalai Lama upholds those teachings. And my understanding about this are twofold. One is that he acknowledges he knows of no teaching from the Buddha himself that censures same-gender sex or sex with those organs. And that what I've heard, and this is just kind of more in the back room, is that basically he has to uphold those teachings because it would create too much disharmony in the Tibetan community for him to come out against those teachings. But I think it's been very important that the insight meditation community has an inclusivity statement, saying that everybody is included in the Buddha's teachings, regardless of sexual preference, that the teachings are based, that the importance that we stress in the teachings are the precepts and the teachings of non-harming. And they're the same for heterosexual or homosexual or whatever proclivity one might have. One other story I like to tell from IMS in the early days was from Mahasi Sayadaw came. And Mahasi Sayadaw is basically in whose lineage we teach. I kind of think of it this way. We teach in two lineages, the lineage of Mahasi Sayadaw, and the form of the meditation we mostly teach is the form that he taught us. And then, of course, we have the stream of Ajahn Chah. And so it's those two streams. But the meditation specifically is from Mahasi. And so Mahasi taught a 3-month course, and at some point a woman asked him, what did he think of sex? And he said he thought sex was gross, base, and disgusting. So that was his teaching. And then at the end, when the 3-month course was over, there was, you know, Integration Week and Dharma Follies. And a woman got up kind of imitating Mahasi a little bit and had somebody ask her about what did she think of sex. And she said she thought it was basic, engrossing, and worth discussing. And I like that story because I think it points up the tension that can be there between the tradition and between our practice here in the West. Now, I've given you a very brief overview, a few stories, a few ideas. The one piece I'd like to leave you with, especially for those of you who are going to come next week, which is a little about Eros. I just want to say something about Eros. If you, like the instruction I was giving in the meditation was to feel the aliveness that's here, whether with the breath or the sounds, or even the pain that might be here, the aliveness. And I would include all of that in the realm of Eros. That Eros often gets limited to sexuality. But I think it might be much more helpful for us to think of sexuality as in the realm of Eros. And that the realm of Eros includes all the senses. And I saw, as I left San Francisco, where I live in San Francisco is totally socked in, foggy. And I drove out into down 280 and it was sunny and beautiful and sunny. And then somewhere along the way there was this one stream of fog coming over the hill. And it was just, and it wasn't distant from the hill, it was up close and tucked in very tight to the hill. And it was very sensual, it was very beautiful, it was very erotic. And what I would like to suggest to you is that it's the Eros of life is part of our practice. That meditation practice itself has an erotic component, not erotic necessarily sexual, but erotic in the greater sense of the aliveness that's here. It's here right now. Even in your tiredness or even in your boredom, there is this erotic component of life, which we see very clearly when we're out in nature, the blooming of a flower or the dying of a flower. Or if you ever watch, I was just sitting at Gaia House in England, and they have a lot of wildlife, and I was just, the wildlife, the beautiful life that just comes from who knows where and is going who knows where. And so, in that sense, I'd like to leave you with a little personal story. You notice there haven't been any personal stories so far. I'm going to give you a personal story about my first kiss. And my first kiss happened when I was maybe 5 years old. And it was a beautiful night in Detroit. And it was warm and humid, but not oppressive. But where you can feel the air and feel your skin, and the sun was setting and it was really, or had set, but it was really like reddish, glowing red and really beautiful, like black sky mixed with red sunset. And I was out late playing. I knew it was late because I wasn't usually out that late. And I had met this girl who I'd never met in the neighborhood before, and it was a neighborhood where kids played a lot of kids. And we were playing, and she was very distinct. I remember her vividly. She had bright carrot red hair and lots of freckles. And maybe she was at least 5, maybe she was 6. And at some point she was eating this red tomato, a whole tomato which she'd picked from like a backyard garden. And I'd never seen anybody eat a tomato. You know, I'd always seen cut tomatoes, but she was eating it like an apple. And I said something to her, and she said, "Oh, here, take a bite." And I took a bite of this tomato, and it was so fresh and so alive. And she kissed me at that moment on the cheek. And I'd never been kissed before, and it was like between the tomato and the kiss. And it was like I almost swooned a little bit. It was so alive. And it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. So I'd like to end there. And next week I'll start with my second kiss. Okay? So thank you for indulging me to allow me to go over a little bit. I appreciate it very much. Let's sit for 1 minute and we'll share the merit. May the sincerity of our practice, our time here, our goodness and good-heartedness, may it be for our benefit, for the benefit of one another, each other. May it be for the benefit of all. May our very lives be for the benefit of all beings. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be free from suffering, the suffering of war, hatred, racism, violence, greed, hunger, fear, division. May all beings be free from suffering. May we all awaken together. May we be free. Ding. Thank you all. I'll see you again next week.